Well, the first I knew about it, shortly, Rob Roy McGregor came up to talk with Mr. Macbeth. And this is how I first learned that they had done some work or were getting interested on it. And what I found out, of course, was that what the first job that Corning had given the fellowship was to, Corning had developed these glass blocks, building blocks, and they didn't want to go into the building business, so what they had done is formed a joint company with Pittsburgh Corning, located at Port Allegheny, I think. Mm-hmm. And the first job that Corning gave Mac and Earl was to find a coating for these blocks, and the first thing they tried was polyvinyl acetate. I don't think there's any question, but what, of course, Union Carbide had big fellowships at Mellon Institute. They were big in that place, and so whatever Union Carbide had, was available to other fellowships. And so, but it stuck so well that it tended to, you know, if you get something that sticks too well with glass and it shrinks, it'll pull clamshells out, it'll spall, cause falling. And so they started using a little polyethyl polysilicate in with the ethyl silicate. They started putting polyethyl polysilicate in there too. I don't know what it was supposed to do, but anyways, that was one of the things that they were doing. And then that got them in the direction of wanting to put an organosilicon, put a methyl group on the silicon. Mm-hmm. They call it internal plasticizing. I always disliked that term because, and I always dislike it when they talk about dimethyl siloxane being high in silica. There's no silicon in the doggone thing. You know, it's 80% something else. And organic, but it's not silica. This is some of the slang that gets into the picture, you know, as they go along. But so then when we found out that they were interested in the organosilicon, we got together and started kind of planning programs and working together pretty well on it. And they, of course, the idea was, well, whatever they're doing, you keep on doing it, and whatever we're doing, we'll keep on doing. That was a good start. We did start talking about some of the fancy things that we might be able to do with organosilicon chemistry. But
how frequently were you getting together?
A couple of months or maybe 3 months, 6 months. It wasn't on a regular, mm-hmm. particular. Later on, it was on a more regular basis. But then I started getting their weekly reports, and so I could keep abreast of what they were doing down there. And then, of course, we were getting towards the war situation. I mean, things were getting pretty. Well, it didn't look good. And, of course, I don't know when the pressure started building to get more materials to work with. And, of course, Owens Corning in Owens, Illinois, they were anxious to sell Rickover or something. They wanted to sell electrical tape, and Rickover wanted smaller, more power out of smaller motors, and this thing dragged along a little bit. By this time we had found out a little more about polymerization, but still the best way, acid was not a good way to polymerize, for instance, a phenylmethyl compound or a phenylethyl compound. We found out later what it was doing is clipping off some of the fennel groups, which was, of course, it gave your body and increased the viscosity. And, of course, we were probably doing some rearrangement. We didn't know at this time how reversible the chlorosilane hydrolysis was and how important the nature of the group attached to it was to the equilibrium hydrolysis involved there. We learned quite a lot about it later on, but this was the way we had at the time of doing this. And then it was along in, was it in 40? I've forgotten now just when DeLong came. We began to have the opportunity to build up our group a little bit. And after we realized what was going on, we heard, I don't know how we heard, that Rockow had given a paper. I think it was at a Detroit ACS meeting, and somebody had got back to Dr. Sullivan. And I think it disturbed Dr. Sullivan a bit because he felt that there was a matter of, from an academic point of view at least, a priority involved in the thing. And so it didn't suit him very well. And we heard that Rockow was going to publish a paper. And so what happened, now Dr. Coolidge at this time was the director of research at GE. You know, he was the great inventor of this Coolidge X-ray tube and things like that. I'm sure that he and Sullivan were good friends, and I think by this route, and Rockow, finally I met him, he came to Corning after a little to-do, and had agreed to hold up his paper while we got one together, which was, it wasn't for me a very good thing, but that's where this DeLong and Hyde paper got in. But already we had decided, although Mac was using the ester synthesis down there, it was clear to me that in the long run we were going to have to go through chlorides, chlorosilanes. So that's why when I got DeLong to our group, I had Dick synthesize some of the chlorosilanes. And he liked distillation. It was aggravating for me because he was taking his old sweet time to do a good job, see. And here he got the, they boil awful close together. I don't know, I got the boiling point somewhere. But he did separate them, so we were able to characterize the methylchlorosilane, the monomer and the dimer. And I'd forgotten about the trimer. I guess that was in there, too. But they're all close boiling and close boiling with silicon tet. See, they're not easy. They're not mean hand materials to handle. But in that, that's the background of how we got a patent on the methylchlorosilane.
That was before the war, was it? Or was that later? I think that there was just one, I think, that I saw before the war.
Well, Rockow's patent came out before the war, but ours got a, our first patent was on the phenylethyl, and it was only later that the methyl, we got a patent on the methylchlorosilane.
I see.
And that caused an uproar. This is a little anecdote. I don't know. Maybe you want to forget it.
No.
But when the patent came out on the methylchlorosilanes and it hit Schenectady, these research people were up in arms. They thought Rockow had been robbed because he'd made these chlorosilane things. And the reason we got the story was that Dr. Lee Fowler at, in our patent department was acquainted with some of the patent people down at GE. So he got the story back. He knew what had happened, and the patent department had to call research people together and tell them that Hyde got the patent because he'd made them first. It didn't set very good with them, I suppose. This is the story as I understand it. That, of course, it's secondhand. But anyhow, then part of the methylchlorosilane story is that we hadn't, the patent hadn't issued very long. I guess I showed you the patent. There's one of
them.
Oh,
yes.
Professor Gilman, you know, Professor Gilman was our first Kipping Award receiver, but he got interested in organosilicon chemistry and published quite a few papers. But he was a very thorough person, and he dug up this Berichter reference that mentioned methylchlorosilanes, and there wasn't much for us to do but disclaim the patent, so that was like giving it to the world. It would have gone anyways, of course, but, and of course, Rockow, when we had this interference, everything, publications or patent applications, all got tied up under secrecy orders till the war was over, and that's when we had this big patent interference with General Electric Company. And so the way that they settled it was to cross-license the patents up to that time. And one of the important GE patents, of course, was this direct process of reacting silicon with methyl chloride. And, of course, we had a lot of pretty good patents, too, as far as that's concerned. So I'll tell you, I wouldn't want to go through an ordeal like that again. I'll tell you, they came to Midland, or came to Corning with their attorneys, and they started taking testimony Monday morning. Of course, this involved Dr. Johansson and Dr. Dowd and some of these others for a short time, but I got the worst of it. They started taking testimony Monday morning until 5. Then on Tuesday they decided that they couldn't get it all in, so they come back after supper from 7 to 9, and then they finished around Friday noon. And I'll tell you, I think I'd been put through the ringer. I wouldn't want to go through that again. You know, every time you make a statement, you're a liar unless you've got some evidence there to say otherwise. And this gets you after a while. Of course, I got it
later. What year was that?
I think this was along in, seems to me it was after, when was the armistice was?
46.
Was the war ended in
46.
Was it 46?
Or 45.
45, I think, in May, something like May. This could have been in September of 45.
Okay.
Because later they went down to GE to take testimony and put Rocco on the spot, which they did. And it was winter time, I remember that. So that could have been along in early December or something like that. They really gave him a pretty good workout, I think. And the man who was the main lawyer in this interference was Fulton B. Flick, I think from Pittsburgh. You know, he was, if I understand it right, he had his PhD in chemistry before he went into law, and he's responsible for this. I think he worked for the Aluminum Company of America, and I think he had the patent. He was responsible for this heavy anodizing of aluminum so that it would take dyes and things like that. That was Fulton B. Flick. And later, I don't know whether you ran into Harry Dingman. Harry Dingman was a chemist, really, to start with, out at Midland. And he went to Pittsburgh, and he worked in Flick's office and got his law degree, I think, from the University of Pittsburgh. He's retired now. He retired last year, but he was head of the Dow Corning Patent Department up to last year. So he is Fulton B. Flick. He died quite a long time ago, but
When was the joint licensing agreement reached then? You testimony in late 45. When did the settlement occur?
It would have to be, I think, in 46. And then, of course, the papers started coming out, papers and patents mm-hmm. and things like that. I think it would have to be in 46.
I'm wondering if we could back up for a moment. I wanted to ask you a little more about Rockow when you met with him at Corning. You said he came to Corning?
Yeah, that's the first time I met him.
Do you remember anything about that first meeting with him?
No, it was in Dr. Sullivan's office. I think he had talked with Dr. Sullivan first, then I think Dr. Sullivan called me up and invited me to come over and meet him. I don't recall any particular thing that was talked about, but I'm pretty sure that he had agreed to hold up his paper till we had one ready to publish, which didn't quite happen. I think his paper came out a month or two before our paper. I've got more of that first paper somewhere. Of course, I got a little better acquainted with him when we had this interference, although not really well. I figured myself that Rockow probably never realized he may not ever have been told that Pat Mode and Marshall came down to Corning. He may never have. But you know, there's another interesting sidelight that I learned. Rockow got his doctorate at Cornell. And one of the, Cornell had this Baker Lecture Series where they brought in people for a year. In fact, Pauling spent a year in Cornell. I listened to one or two of Pauling's lectures when I was at Corning. But also Alfred Stock. And Stock did some early work with the organosilicon compounds. And this was one of the, I don't know whether this, I'm not, I don't want to belittle Rockow or anything, but Rockow didn't seem to remember that he worked as a grad student for Stock. And Stock had made dimethyl silane with two hydrogens on it, of course, okay. But of course he never did anything with it or mm-hmm. probably never hydrolyzed it. I don't know that Rockow should be responsible for that, but he had made a dimethyl silane back in those days, quite early.
When the war, this was all in the late 30s then, that this occurred. Then the war started, and there was demand for more of these materials. And somewhere along the line, a fire occurred.
Oh, I used to call that the Chicago fire. Well, what happened, we got pretty careless with ether. Of course, you use a lot of ether in the Grignard operation. But I had been trying to make a continuous Grignard out of the phenyl compound, and I had a stirring motor on there that wasn't actually explosion-proof. But here, DeLong had set up a distillation. We used hot water to boil off the ether. But what he had forgotten to do was he put corks in the ends of the condenser to keep everything dry while it was just sitting there, and he forgot to take one of the corks out. And here he was heating a pretty good-sized pot of ether with the thing blocked off, and I used to do quite a bit of, if I had something to fix, I had a little blast furnace or a blast lamp right on the side bench there, and that had there was a little flame on it, pilot flame on it, and we were sitting there talking, and all of a sudden, he remembered what he had done. And I wondered why it wasn't boiling, why we weren't getting a distillate. And here there was a little steam coming out. And all of a sudden it hit him, and he shot out the door and down the stairs. I think he was out on Market Street by the time it happened. I don't know. He knew what he'd done. And as soon as I saw the thing pop like this, I quick ran over to douse the, I put the flame out on my with my hands and started out the door about the time it caught fire. And here was a great big billow of fire and smoke over my head. All I got was a few little spatters of ether on the back of my ears. But we learned a lesson from that. Ethers, you can't get careless with it. It did is set off the sprinklers and messed up the whole floor. We had people sweeping water down the hall and down the stairs. Fortunately, the building is made of concrete, so it didn't soak in.
Is that when... I guess I'm looking at where the connection with Dow was made. Was this an accident, the beginning of...
No, this didn't... This was before that. This didn't have anything to do. Dr. Bessenstein and these people were putting pressure on Dr. Sullivan, and I was trying to make them in a little larger quantities, and then I began to realize that when it comes to the engineering and the pilot plant work, already we had contacted anybody at Dow, but I could see that that we weren't, this was a long time thing, and we weren't going to be able to do anything in a reasonable length of time. And I knew that, of course, that Dow had the raw materials and the engineering skill and equipment, so I suggested to Dr. Sullivan that that we contact Dow and see if they might manufacture for us. And the only way we had of resinifying still at that time was to use acid on the material, and phenylethyl looked like it would be the thing to go with. The methyl grignard was a miserable thing to handle. It was so insoluble. The solubility was so very low. So he talked to Dr. Britton and invited him down to see what we had in mind. Dr. Sullivan did it, in fact. And then later on, he heard from Dr. Britton, and they had agreed to try some pilot plant runs in a little larger kettle out in Dr. Britton's Building 20 laboratory out in Midland. And the first one, for, as usual with pilot plant effort, the first few are usually disasters. And this was no exception. Dr. Clarence Moyle was a new man coming into Dr. Britton's laboratory, and he's the one that got the job of trying out these first experimental pilot plant tries at making a resin. We finally got some that was reasonably good. I think about this time, we have been in 42. This was during 40, 41. But I think in the upshot of it was that Britton could see some broad possibilities, and he got interested in the thing too, and it began to look like it was a pretty complex thing. And I don't know all of the details of back and forth between the two managements, but I think the war had already started, hadn't it?
War started in 41, late 41. So.
December 7th, 41, right. Wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So it was during 41 that these pilot plants that Moyle was trying out, and then when the war broke, I think during 42, I think the war had started, and the decision was, well, it's a complex, the only way to handle it. And Rickover was on their heels. There was no question about that. And some of that is in this book that of Collings that you'll get. And so it was decided over a handshake that that's the best way to handle it, will form a Dow Corning Corporation. And they were, the way Mac was working, of course, on Sullivan's, that bothered Mac and Earl. Sullivan thought, well, gee whiz, we bought them a big kettle down there, a nice kettle. Why can't they make some of this clothes, Eileen? He kept insisting, and they tried it, and it was a kind of a disaster. They just drove everybody out of the Mellon Institute basement, I guess. But, so, anyhow, this Rickover was on their trail, too. He was trying to push the thing, I know. The only time I met Rickover, already they had started to do something out in Midland, over in the Dow plant, actually. And this was after, I think, Collings and Bass came down to Corning to help get things all together. But that was the only time I met Rickover, once when he came out to Midland, and he was anxious to see things going. And I think that was the start of the motor program that they started over. They started that over in Dow.
Yeah.
And the there was, I can't say just when this meeting was in Corning, but I think Dr. Bass and W.R. Collings and Dr. Britton came down, and Mac and Earl came up from Mellon. The idea was to put every bit of experience and understanding and research together to get things rolling. And I know that we still didn't have a decent polymerization. Although, we were getting into the alkali monkey business before this time. We already had learned that we could make some high polymers and that we could depolymerize and purify the intermediates. We already knew that because one of the things I remember so well, we met in Dr. Littleton's office, and everybody, and Mac and Earl had brought along they called it rubber, but it was made from a gel. It was really, we'd call it just a mush, I guess, now. But they had attempted to make a piece of rubber out of it. And of course, this, again, was going to depend on making some decent polymer. And they brought that along, and they brought some of the oils. Well, we already had some of Mac's oils in the laboratory up at Corning. And I think Dr. Bass was taking notes at a terrific rate. I don't know of anyone that could get down so much in a short space and have it all organized and readable. He just had everything down pat. And of course, when he saw some of the oils and saw, I don't know whether Mac had already measured some viscosity, temperature slopes. You know, they had thought of making a lubricant for a mine safety appliance, and whether they'd already run some tests. We still didn't have a decent polymer business, but I think that was the case. I think Mac must have had this flat temperature viscosity slope property, because when Shaler saw this, he recognized right away that if he knew about this ignition junction failure on planes that were trying to fly across the Atlantic. And so right off the bat, it dawned on him that if he put a filler in there with this flat temperature viscosity slope, he'd have a grease to fill these junctions that would prevent the flashover and it wouldn't run out. And that was the first product. And of course, the big alkylation reactors, cellulose, you know, they made the ethyl cellulose and methyl cellulose. Those reactors were usable to make the 9-methyl by the etherless Grignard.